This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Eating is one of life's more enjoyable pleasures. And while it can be lots of fun to put food in our mouths, few of us like to contemplate what happens to our lunch after we eat it. Well, right now, we're going to take you on a trip down the food chute, also known as the alimentary canal.
Come one, come all to the famous alimentary amusements, open for digestion. We've got glands and glee, bile and smiles, and that's not all. Lunch is just the opening act, and everything comes out okay.
Here we go. A trailer from the latest book by Mary Roach, a writer known for asking taboo and wacky questions about the human body. And she continues this pursuit with her new book, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. She takes readers on a journey from an oral processing lab in the Netherlands to a gut microflora party in Minnesota. And she joins us now to talk about it. Mary Roach, welcome to the State of Things. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. I know you've written a number of books tackling these kind of taboo topics. What got you writing about all this stuff?
I don't know what it is about me. I'm kind of the bottom feeder of nonfiction. whatever everybody else turns away from, I'm like, oh, I'll take that. I'll do that. I don't know. I have a sick sense of curiosity. I guess it's just something. I do think, though, that I tend to think that I write about things that everyone finds interesting until they realize they're not supposed to find them interesting, but secretly they still do.
Or you find them interesting until you find out why they're so interesting. I think that may be the other part of it because, the human digestive system, for instance, what got you thinking about that?
Well, the book before was Packing for Mars, which had to do with space-related, astronaut-related things. And I stumbled upon a study that I didn't end up using in that book where at Berkeley, California, University of California, Berkeley, the nutrition lab, they brought a bunch of students in. This was a NASA project. They were trying to figure out what could we feed people on the way to Mars that would be easy to grow and not take up a lot of room. And somebody had this great idea. I know, we'll grow bacteria and we'll serve them a slurry of bacteria. And I thought, the science of eating and food really has gone to some strange places, and I think it might be a fun place to explore.
All right. So tell us about this. You actually take us on a journey top to bottom, as it were, what it is that happens to your food, right?
That's right. Starting with the nose and the mouth all the way on through to the back door. It's the alimentary canal. It's an odd place in that it's almost more like the outside of our bodies. It's kind of a donut hole that we all have because this is a place where unspeakably vile, smelly, bacteria-laden things are going on, whereas the rest of the body is supposed to be sterile, one hopes. It's kind of like an offshore gambling zone. It's this place that, you know, different rules seem to apply in there. So, and it's one long tube, even though the mouth looks very different from the stomach, which looks very different from the small intestine and the colon, but they're all linked. It's an extraordinary place.
A protein laundering operation, as it were.
Exactly.
It starts with the nose. We don't shove much food up our nose, and yet a vital part in the process. So tell us about the nose.
Yes, the nose. I wasn't aware of this. When you talk about flavor, 80% of that is the nose. When you chew food and you hold it in your mouth and warm it up, you're allowing these gases basically to escape, and they waft up into the nose, and they're processed and experienced as part of taste. But taste is really, it's very basic: salt, sweet, sour, bitter, and brothy is the other one. Everything else, lemon and all those wonderful components of coffee and wine and gin and, you know, blackberry and cherry and citrus and melon, almost an infinite variety of aromas. That's all going on in the nose.
And it certainly makes sense to a certain degree. I mean, in some ways, you don't want your mouth to be the first time you notice you shouldn't be eating this, right? I mean, something should come from the outside in without actually getting into your bloodstream. And the nose, I guess, operates that way.
Yeah, the nose is the first line of defense. It's this sentry in the middle of our face that is letting us know, you know, if this smells rank and funky, it probably shouldn't be allowed in the front door.
Now, that I kind of always knew. What I didn't know is that, in effect, we have two sets of nostrils, right? Tell us about what's going on up there.
That's wild. How could I'm 54 years old. I've gone my whole life thinking I have one set of nostrils. How could I not know my own bite? There's another set, the internal nares, I guess is the pronunciation. Anyway, that's in the back of the mouth. It's an opening up into the nose. And this is wild. There's two kinds of smelling that you do. There's one that's the classic sniff, and that's on the inhale. But when you hold food in your mouth and you're chewing, if you exhale at the same time, you are sniffing. It's on the exhale, wafting these aromatic gases up into the nose. And you can really, I have a much better appreciation now when I'm drinking wine or something with a lot of those volatile aromas. You exhale and you appreciate far more of them. You look a little strange as you do it. I make an odd face, my husband tells me. But
here's the thing. When I was little, I used to hum while I ate. And people would notice this. They would say, why are you humming? And I would just look at them like, well, because it makes my food taste better. And I
exactly.
Right? And I had no idea, but this is what I was doing. So my son did the same thing, and it was like, well, folks, we taste through our nose, and I didn't realize I was pushing it up through an extra set of nostrils, but apparently that's what I was doing.
What you're doing. As long as you don't
vibrating
get too,
it. Yeah, so you can imagine like giving it a little wiggle, putting a little spin on your taste, right? That's going on.
I think you're on to something.
Erectile tissue in the nose, though? Tell us more.
Yes. Apparently, there are only two sites in the body with erectile tissue. And the first one, you can all guess. The second one, when I ask people, they tend to say the nipples, but that's a different mechanism. That's little muscles contracting at the base of the nipple and standing it up. The other place is the lining of the nose. That's when you have a cold, when you're congested, that's basically an erection in your nose.
The cold is the it's not that.
No,
that
when you have a cold, all the erectile tissue, it's absorbing all the mucus and it's swelling up. So that's why you're congested, and that's why you have trouble breathing. It's all swelling up. It's becoming erect. So it's kind of an erection of the nose.
But it's not pleasant. It's not as though you're really excited about your food in a way.
It's not. It doesn't have the same sensual properties and feelings, but it is the tissue works in a similar way. The expanding and the getting larger aspect of it, not the feeling good and making you want to do some other things.
Want to have more, because that's it. You don't want to have another cold, unlike... Well, anyway, let's move on, because here's the thing I want to ask.
You can't take the comparison too far.
You can. In fact, it's kind of counterintuitive. But you were on a taste testing panel yourself, tasting olive oil, and it didn't go so well for you personally.
No, it didn't. I saw a call for tryouts. They were holding tryouts for the olive oil flavor panel. And this was up at the Mondavi Institute at University of California. Yeah, Davis, mm-hmm. where they do a lot of wine and food. So I went up there, and I was the only one who didn't work in the olive oil industry, and it really showed. I got a call, an email later in the day that said, "Thank you so much, Mary, for coming for the tryouts. I'm afraid you didn't make the cut," which I'm a very competitive. I was a straight-A kid, and that really hurt. But I have no what was fascinating to me was here was a group of men and women who spoke another language. They could pick out these flavor or aroma notes in olive oil that to me it all just was, well, it's a little grassy with maybe a peppery finish. They all seemed like that to me. But these folks, through experience, and you can actually educate your nose by studying the individual smell components that go that are typically found in whether it's olive oil or wine. And it's almost like learning vocabulary and learning a new language. And I came in not speaking that language and failed miserably.
Well, yeah, but you gave it a try. You also went to an oral processing lab in the Netherlands. In fact, you have a part. Maybe I could ask you to read that section in your book about the oral.
Yes, of course.
From the Nederlands.
When I told people I was traveling to Food Valley, I described it as the Silicon Valley of eating. 15,000 scientists dedicated to improving or, depending on your sentiments about processed food, compromising the quality of our meals. At the time I made the Silicon Valley comparison, I didn't expect to be served actual silicone. But here it is in front of me, a bowl of rubbery white cubes the size of salad croutons. Andries Vanderbilt brought them from his lab in the brusquely named Department of Head and Neck at the nearby University Medical Center, Utrecht. "You chew them," he says to me. Vanderbilt has studied chewing for 25 years. If a man can be said to resemble a tooth, Vanderbilt is a lower incisor, long and bony with a squared-off head and a rigid, straight-backed way of sitting. He uses the cubes to quantify masticatory performance, how effectively a person chews. Research subjects chew a cube 15 times and then return it in its new un-cube-like state to Vanderbilt, who pushes it through a set of sieves to see how many bits are fine enough to pass through. The way you chew is as unique and consistent as the way you walk or fold your shirts. There are fast chewers and slow chewers, long chewers and short chewers, right-chewed people and left-chewed people. Vanderbilt told me about a study in which 87 people came into a lab and chewed an identical amount of shelled peanuts. Though all had a full complement of healthy teeth, the number of chews ranged from 17 to 110. Your oral processing habits are a physiological fingerprint. And as with the finger kind, none of us have any idea what ours looks like. We couldn't pick our own chewing mouths out of a lineup, although it would be interesting to try.
There's Mary Roach reading from her latest book, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. She's going to be at the Carolina Theater in Durham on Sunday. I will be with you, and we'll be doing much what we're doing right now at the Carolina Theater. But tell me more about this now, about chewing and kind of what it tells us about it. And I guess saliva is the other key element in all this, right? So,
yeah, well, chewing, one of the things Dr. Vanderbilt, explained to me, which was, again, counterintuitive, like so much of this book, that the jaws and the teeth, most people think of them as extremely strong and kind of like basically mortar and pestle, kind of dumb mallets. They're not, the teeth are, they're actually extraordinarily sensitive. You're able to detect a grain of sand, like something like 10 microns across. If you're eating something that's soft, your teeth are able to pick out this tiny hard thing and sort of alert you that, oh, there's a different consistency here. You know, you need to monitor how you're chewing. The other thing I loved about chewing, when you bite down on a peanut, at the moment the peanut gives way, your jaw muscles cut out. Because if they didn't, your teeth would continue to hurtle together and smash into each other and you would possibly break your teeth. So this is all going on unconsciously. You've got this system whereby it's making fine-tuned adjustments and kind of amazing.
That has to be learned behavior, right? I mean, you probably got that wrong.
No, that's all that's automatic. As the pressure, you've got these sensors, and when the peanut breaks and the resistance is less than you, there's, it's called the quiet period when the muscles cut out and they stop hurtling. The quiet period. I like that.
I like that you have a book about erectile tissue in noses and mastication. This, to me, is the stuff of a bestseller. So right chewing and left chewing, this is something also I've noticed about myself, and I thought, I wonder if this is true for everybody, if we kind of prefer one side, because I noticed it, and I thought, I wonder what this is all about. And you know, is there any kind of adaptive advantage to chewing on one side or the other?
No, it's just a habit. They actually have a term, right chewed, like left-handed or right-handed. There's right chewed and left chewed. And for some folks, if there's a sensitive, if you've got teeth on one side that are sensitive to hot or cold, there may be a preference to. So sometimes there's a reason, but a lot of times it's just how you are. It's your little quirk.
Okay, saliva, much more interesting than I ever thought.
Saliva, yeah, you need to respect your saliva, people. It's a substance that we revile. It's the most disgusting thing we can. I mean, there's a psychologist in University of Pennsylvania, Paul Rosen, who studies disgust, and he's written about saliva. And he did this study where you had people think of, imagine your favorite soup, and how likely, scale of 1 to 10, are you to eat this soup if it's put in front of you? Everybody says 10. Oh, yeah, I'd love to have that soup. And he goes, now imagine leaning over and spitting into the soup. Now how likely are you to eat your favorite soup? And then it goes down to 0. People, and even it's their own saliva, and they're going to be mixing the soup with their saliva. Oh, yeah. But as soon as the Yeah, as soon as it leaves the boundary of the self, it's this transformed into this hideous thing. But it is a fairly miraculous substance. It's of course a lubricating substance, but that's just the beginning. It's also when you eat or drink something with on the acid end of the pH scale, like wine, orange juice, vinegar, cola, you will feel, if you're paying attention, this gush of saliva, and that is to dilute the acid and protect your tooth enamel, because that kind of acid will break down tooth enamel quite effectively. So I was in this saliva lab, and the researcher, this beautiful Italian woman who you don't expect to be in a saliva lab. I don't know why. It's just not my image of a saliva researcher.
Yeah.
But this beautiful, well-dressed Italian woman, she put it with a medicine dropper, dropped some vinegar on my tongue, and she's going, "Do you feel it? Do you feel it?" I'm like, "Yes, wow, this gush of saliva coming in like the cavalry, you know, to protect my teeth." And I got all, you know, she has this infectious enthusiasm for saliva and the miracles of saliva.
This is great. Do you feel it? Do you feel it? I love this.
Do you feel it?
People are listening to this segment. I promised them that we're going to be on a journey. It started with the nose. We're at saliva. They know it's almost over. And so everybody is breathing a sigh of relief. Because we're still so far north that we will never, ever possibly get to the rectum. And yet, I must ask you about your visit to a prison in New Jersey.
Avenal State Prison, yes. I went to a prison because, well, I had to do something. I had to cover the rectum. And I thought, what would be the setting? What would be? I didn't want to do just something on diseases of the rectum. I'm interested in the healthy plumbing here. So I thought, I know what is okay. The rectum, it's a storage facility, basically, is what it is. So I thought, who would have some expertise? And then I thought about those people who smuggle drugs on the alimentary canal, either by swallowing it or putting it the other way. So I went to a prison with the blessings of the Department of Corrections, who set up the interview. And I sat and I interviewed a man, actually a convicted murderer, as it turned out, about his ability to override the defecatory reflex and how difficult that is, and does it get harder, how many hours go by before you really have to struggle. And we had a very strange conversation.
Was he sitting?
Interesting.
I just wondered. Was he sitting?
He was sitting.
Okay,
he wasn't. Yeah. He wasn't using at the time his prison wallet, as it is known.
Prison wallet. You've uncovered so many great, colorful terms. Well, so what was the biggest surprise for you in all this?
Oh, here's one. Here's a fun term: nasal regurgitation. That's when you hork milk out your nose. Kids do it a lot because I don't. Maybe you do it when you're humming when you eat your food.
I do. Just little bits of it would come out to prove to people how good it was.
yeah, and if you get to a particularly exuberant patch in the song, you could have to be careful with
nasal. The famous spit take in every sitcom. What else? What was a big that's a cool term.
Nasal regurgitation.
Yeah.
The stomach, this was surprising to me. It is very, very difficult to burst a human stomach. You have to really pack in a lot of food, because what the stomach will do, the stomach will outsmart you at a certain point. It has stretch receptors, and it knows when it's getting dangerously full, and it will just empty itself, and you got nothing to say about it. That stuff's coming out. It's a regurgitation reflex, and that protects your stomach from bursting. There you go.
Mary Roach, thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Thank you.
Mary Roach is the author of Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. She's going to be talking about the book, and I'll be with her on the stage at the Carolina Theater in Durham this Sunday. And you can see the trailer and find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up, the old ceremony returns to the State of Things. Stay tuned.
So won't you take my hand?